Good morning. Thank you for joining us at the Heritage Foundation. I'm John Hilbolt, Director of Lectures and Seminars. It's my privilege to welcome you to our Lehrman Auditorium. We, of course, welcome those who join us on the heritage.org website. We remind our in-house guests we would appreciate your checking that cell phones and other electronic devices have been turned off to avoid electronic interference. And, of course, those that are viewing online are reminded that questions can be submitted via email, addressed simply to speaker@heritage.org throughout the program. Our program will, of course, be posted again within 24 hours on the Heritage website for your future reference. Hosting our debate today in this event that is also co-sponsored by the Federalist Society here in Washington is Edwin Meese. Mr. Meese, of course, serves Heritage as the Ronald Reagan Distinguished Fellow in Public Policy. He is also our chairman for our Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. His illustrious background, of course, includes service as the 75th Attorney General of the United States. Please join me in welcoming Chairman Meese. Mr. Meese.
Thank you, John, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Heritage Foundation and our co-sponsor, the Federalist Society, we're pleased to welcome both our audience here in Lehrman Auditorium and also those who may be watching on the Internet. Today, our topic is hate crimes, what is the proper federal role? Traditionally, criminal law, its prosecution and its enforcement has concentrated on the action that is involved in a particular crime, with the addition, of course, of the mental state, the mens rea, or intent to commit the crime, and in some cases a specific intent. Traditionally, very little attention has been paid to other things that are extraneous, such as the personal feelings or motivation of the perpetrator or the status of the individual who happens to be the victim. Recently, the concept of hate crimes, in which the motivation or personal feelings of the perpetrator, or in some cases the status of the victim, have been an important part of whether or not a particular offense qualifies as a so-called hate crime. Today we're going to be looking at that situation, particularly as it concerns the federal role. Is it appropriate to have legislation which takes into account these other extraneous matters in addition to the act itself? And secondly, is this a proper thing for the federal government to be doing? Is there a reason, for example, such as a lack of enforcement at the local level, why some would say the federal government should step in? Are there constitutional problems? Does, for example, this idea of looking at the motivation of the perpetrator have anything to do with perhaps affecting First Amendment rights? Are there experiences in other countries where the concept of hate crimes has led to interference with free speech and which has been allowed the concept to be extrapolated into things other than actual what have been traditional criminal activity? To discuss this topic, we have four experts in the law who are here to discuss it, and I will introduce each of them just before they speak. Our first speaker will be Mark Agrast. Mark is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, but he has a long bit of experience here in Washington, D.C. in terms of the Constitution, civil liberties, and related legal matters. He has been a staff member on the Congress and the House of Representatives, and he has been involved also as a practitioner of law, both in the field of international law as well as in civil liberties and criminal law. He has devoted a great deal of his time to issues such as those that we're dealing with today, and it's a pleasure to have him define the legislation that is currently before the Congress and also to give a few views on it to kick off our program. Please join me in welcoming Mark Agrast.
Thank you very much, General Meese. It's always a privilege to be on a panel with you, and I'm delighted to be here on behalf of the Center for American Progress with our friends from the Heritage Foundation. I'm told that We are members of the same baseball league as well, and I understand that Heritage bested the Center for American Progress the other night, so of course I'm eager to try to score a few points today. Before I offer my own opening remarks, I have been asked to summarize the provisions of the bill, which is H.R. 1592, the Local Law Enforcement Hate Crimes Prevention Act of 2007, and to describe the current state of play on Capitol Hill. I'm going to try to do this in just a very few minutes, but that'll help set the background for this panel. Then I'd like to devote the rest of my allotted time to a discussion of why I think the bill represents good policy from a Federalist perspective. There's been a federal hate crimes statute since 1968. It's codified at 18 U.S.C. 245B. That statute prohibits the use of force or threat of force to injure, intimidate, or interfere with any person because of his race, color, religion, or national origin. The statute requires proof that victims were attacked because they were engaging in one of six enumerated federally protected activities, such as voting. This requirement has severely limited the ability of federal law enforcement officials to work with state and local officials in the investigation and prosecution of hate-motivated violence, and H.R. 1592 would eliminate that requirement. The bill also would expand the coverage of the 1968 law to include hate crimes based on gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability, all of which are already covered under the 1994 Hate Crime Sentencing Enhancement Act and part of the definitions under that law. The bill provides support to state, local, and tribal law enforcement officials through grants and direct investigative and prosecutorial assistance. It also authorizes appropriations to hire additional Justice Department personnel. The other major provision of the bill amends the Federal Criminal Code to authorize federal prosecutions of some biased-motivated crimes in which the perpetrator willfully caused or attempted to cause bodily injury. But before a federal prosecution can be initiated, the Justice Department must certify that it has consulted with state or local law enforcement officials and determined that, A, the state lacks jurisdiction or does not intend to exercise jurisdiction over the offense, B, the state has requested that the federal government assume jurisdiction, C, the state does not object to the federal government's assuming jurisdiction, or D, the state verdict or sentence failed to vindicate the federal interest. Finally, the bill provides that the act shall not be construed to prohibit any expressive conduct protected by the First Amendment, either the free speech or the free exercise clause. The Congressional Budget Office, which is charged with determining how much legislation will cost, has estimated that the bill would cost $20 million over a five-year period from 2008 to 2012. The CBA also concluded that the measure imposes no intergovernmental or private sector mandates as defined in the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act and imposes no costs on state, local, or tribal governments. H.R. 1592 was passed by the House almost exactly a year ago today, May 3, 2007, on a bipartisan vote of 237 to 180. Similar legislation has passed the House three previous times and has passed the Senate twice. They just haven't managed to figure out how to pass them at the same time. It is now pending in the Senate once again, where Senators Edward Kennedy and Gordon Smith have introduced a bipartisan counterpart with 43 co-sponsors. With that as a summary, let me spend my allotted time discussing, my views on why this legislation is in fact a good idea. In 1998, the American Bar Association Task Force on the Federalization of Criminal Law issued a report which was co-chaired by our distinguished moderator, Mr. Meese. One of its key conclusions was, and I'm quoting, "To create a federal crime, a strong federal interest in the matter should be clearly shown. That is, a distinctly federal interest beyond the mere conclusion that the conduct should be made criminal by some appropriate governmental entity," close quote. let me say at the outset that I largely agree with this conclusion and that I believe the proposed legislation passes that test. Too often, these discussions of federalism and congressional legislation devolve into sterile debates about doctrine. In my view, whether there is an adequate federal interest is a supremely practical question, not an ideological one. We should ask, as the ABA task force did, is the problem a serious one? And if so, is it one in which there is a genuine federal interest and an appropriate federal role? Let me offer a brief answer to each of these three questions. First, the problem. Hate crimes are qualitatively different than ordinary acts of violence. They involve the purposeful selection of victims for violence and intimidation based on their group characteristics, whether real or perceived. As such, they target not only individuals, but entire communities. Their goal is to terrorize and destabilize. Speaking for a unanimous Supreme Court in Wisconsin versus Mitchell in 1993, Chief Justice Rehnquist upheld a hate crime statute on the grounds that such crimes inflict greater harms on the community than ordinary offenses. He quoted with approval Blackstone's observation that it is but reasonable that among crimes of different natures, those should be most severely punished which are the most destructive of the public safety and happiness. Second, the federal interest. Hate crimes are a problem of national scope, which requires national solutions. Like the nationwide epidemic some years ago of church fires, hate crimes pose a threat of contagion, not only to particular communities, but to the national community as well. This does not mean that every purely local crime should be prosecuted federally. In fact, the bill requires the government to certify that there is a nexus to interstate commerce before undertaking a federal prosecution. As such, the bill comports with such Supreme Court precedents as U.S. v. Lopez and U.S. v. Morrison, which, as most of you will know, define the permissible bounds of congressional power under the Commerce Clause. Third, the federal role. There is an appropriate federal role in assisting state and local law enforcement officials in preventing, investigating, and prosecuting hate crimes, and in providing a backstop when state and local officials are unable or unwilling to prosecute these offenses. Proponents of the bill recognize that the primary responsibility rests with state and local governments in this area, and would continue to do so once the bill became law. But it's clear that many of those governments lack the resources to address the problem effectively without federal assistance. According to the Police Executive Research Forum, or PERF, quote, "This measure is critical to helping law enforcement effectively address the ravaging effects of hate crimes on both the victims of these crimes and the communities destabilized by the fear and anger they generate. In the past, PERF has opposed efforts to expand the federal government's authority over traditionally local crimes. However, given the unusual nature of hate crimes and the substantial gaps in state laws, PERF believes in a significant federal role in combating hate crimes." That's why the bill has been endorsed by 31 state attorneys general and leading law enforcement organizations, including the National Association of Attorneys General, the National District Attorneys Association, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and the National Sheriffs Association, as well as by former officials such as Dick Thornburg, who was appointed by President Reagan to succeed Attorney General Meese. Given the jurisdictional limitations in the bill, there is no basis for believing that it would significantly supplant state prosecutions, any more than has been the case with similar statutes that sought to encourage federal-state cooperation in responding to other targeted acts of violence. These include the Violence Against Women Act of 1994, which addressed gender-based violence, but did not lead to federalization of all sexual assault cases, and the Church Arson Prevention Act of 1988, which did not federalize all church arson cases, 80% of which continued to be prosecuted in state courts under state laws. In summary, where the localities can handle the situation themselves, federal intervention would seem unwarranted. But where they need and seek assistance, or where they are unable or unwilling to act, a federal role is both necessary and appropriate. A dogmatic federalism that would turn a deaf ear to the problem serves neither local nor national interests. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Agras. Our next speaker is Professor Gail Harriet. Professor Harriet is a member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights and is also professor of law at one of our outstanding law schools, the University of San Diego. I throw that in since I taught there before I came to Washington some time ago. She's an expert in the field of civil rights, employment law, product liability, remedies, torts. She has a broad background in legal education. She also is a frequent contributor to law review articles throughout the country. She is a editor and co-author of a forthcoming book on about California's Proposition 209 and the principle of non-discrimination. She also served as civil rights counsel to the United States Senate Committee on the Judiciary and was a former dean of associate dean of academic affairs at George Mason University here close by us. She has also been in private practice, and her activities outside of being professor of law, her work on the commission, she's an expert in the field that we're talking about today. So it's a pleasure to have with us Gail Harriet. Please join me in welcoming her.
Well, obviously, I am not here to argue in favor of hate crimes. What I'm here to do is to argue against hate crimes legislation, and particularly federal hate crimes legislation. After the Jasper and Laramie murders in the late 1990s, many well-meaning people thought, you know, there ought to be a law, preferably a federal one. And of course, there is a law. Murder is illegal everywhere, regardless of its motive. When I last checked, which was a few years ago, all but 8 states have additional special hate crimes statutes. No one has claimed that state authorities have neglected their duty to enforce those laws. Unfortunately, hate crimes tragedies became an opportunity for political grandstanding, and grandstanding usually leads to ill-considered legislation. All hate crimes laws, state or federal, have a certain number of problems. Number one, why should James Byrd's killers be treated differently from Jeffrey Dahmer or Ted Kaczynski? Many hate crimes are surely horrible, but there are other crimes that are equally horrible. Two, what happens if the law is not even-handedly enforced? Crime statistics show that among racially inspired murders, for example, black-on-white attacks are significantly more common than white-on-black. Should they all be punished as hate crimes, or just the ones that fit the skinhead stereotype? In the end, will all this help or hurt the cause of racial harmony? Three, it's argued that hate crime statutes are needed to make women and minorities feel that the law takes their well-being seriously. But it seems to me that we may have a problem here. Sooner or later, a high-profile crime is going to occur, and the public is going to be convinced that it's a hate crime, and they may be right. And the jury may nevertheless convict only for the underlying crime. And again, the jury might be wrong on that. Maybe the hate crime should have been convicted for. But the public is going to wind up feeling cheated. They're going to feel that they have not been completely vindicated. When had no hate crime existed, they would have felt vindicated. But let me talk about the special problems involved with federal hate crimes legislation, and in particular, the particular bill that we're talking about today, because I believe there are problems with the federal legislation that should make even those who favor state hate crime legislation want to reject the federal approach. Now, advocates of a federal hate crimes law, or at least this particular one, have said that we need these laws because state procedures often make it difficult to obtain convictions. They cite in particular a Texas case that involved an attack on several black men by a number of white hoodlums. Texas law required that the three defendants be tried separately. By prosecuting them under federal law, however, they could have been tried together had there been a statute in time. Out-of-court admissions by one of those defendants, therefore, could have been used in the case involving all three of them and would not have been excluded as hearsay. But isn't this just an end run around state procedures designed to ensure a fair trial? The people of Texas evidently believe that separate trials are necessary to ensure that innocent men and women are not punished. That's the judgment they've made. No one is claiming that Texas only applies this rule when the victim is black or the victim is gay. And surely nobody is arguing that Texans are soft on crime. I'm reminded of a cartoon I saw a couple years ago involving the death penalty with two very grizzled cowboys drinking coffee out on the range together. And one of them says to the other, they say that here in Texas we've executed innocent men. That ain't true. There are no innocent men in Texas. Texans aren't soft on crime. Probably the most serious aspect of the problem is the double jeopardy issue, which all federal criminal laws inevitably raise. The dual sovereignty rule, which allows the federal government to prosecute a defendant even if he's been acquitted in a state court of a similar crime and vice versa, makes most people a little bit uneasy, I think. At least it makes me uneasy. But we've been able to live with it because the opportunities for double prosecutions seldom arose, since traditionally at least so few federal crimes were on the books. But that's changed in recent years. And in recent years, the practice of double prosecutions when someone has been acquitted at the state level have become more common. Two examples that you might be familiar with are the very emotionally charged cases involving Rodney King and the Crown Heights prosecution a few years back. Perhaps the Sean Bell acquittal in the Sean Bell case involving the death of Sean Bell may give rise to another opportunity for a double prosecution like this. But that should make us feel somewhat uncomfortable. The proposed hate crimes law, like all wholesale expansions of the federal criminal code, creates a very real risk of routine double jeopardy. Every case will give rise to a potential two bites at the apple. Why go down that road? Federal hate crimes laws also divert resources away from frontline crime fighting. Unlike state hate crimes laws, which give prosecutors an extra weapon, to be used or not used as they see fit, federal laws bring in a whole new cast of characters to prosecute the cases. Same crimes are already being handled by state authorities often, and although the statute tries to deal with this problem, turf battles are going to be inevitable as ambitious prosecutors jockey for position to prosecute sexy cases. No one benefits. One thing you have to keep in mind with the hate crime statute is that it is drafted extremely broadly. You hear it referred to as a hate crime statute. It is therefore natural to believe it must require hatred. It does not. There is no requirement that the crime be inspired by hatred of racial groups, ethnic groups, women, men, whatever it happens to be. There is no such requirement. It is sufficient if the defendant acts because of, that's the language, because of someone's race, color, religion, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, or disability. Consider this, ladies and gentlemen. Rapists are seldom indifferent to the gender of their victims. They always choose the victim because of their gender. In law school classes, you can have discussions about the hypothetical bisexual rapist, but that is not something that happens very often. And even when it does, the bisexual is seldom going to be indifferent to the gender of his victim at that particular moment. But let's also consider disability. A thief might well steal only from people who are physically weaker or disabled, because in general, they are less able to defend themselves. If you have a choice between stealing the purse of someone in a wheelchair or stealing the purse of someone who can walk, you're going to pick the person who is in the wheelchair. Literally, that person is chosen because of his disability. This was not simply sloppy draftsmanship. The language was chosen deliberately. A decade ago, I had an opportunity when I was working on the Hill to discuss this with representatives of the Clinton administration from the Justice Department. And I innocently thought that this was drafted this way simply because no one was thinking. And I said, hey, what about this rape situation? Well, you know, isn't that going to mean that every rape, the person acted because of the gender of the victim? And I thought they would back away from it. But they did not. They absolutely refused to say that the statute would not cover all rapes. That was something that they definitely wanted to hold as a possibility. Think about that. Because of the race, gender, disability, sexual orientation, it is very hard to come up with a crime that is not going to be covered by this. If you want to cover a crime, you're going to be able to make, particularly with disability. You know, my secretary isn't typing fast enough, maybe because she has some difficulty with carpal tunnel syndrome. I swat her. Hate crime? I'm afraid it just might be. Anyway, I will stop there.
Thank you, Professor Harriet. Our next speaker is Stephen Freeman. Mr. Freeman is the director of the Legal Affairs Department of the Anti-Defamation League. He has been in that department previously before he became director, and he also has responsibility as associate director of the Anti-Defamation League Civil Rights Division. He has spent much of his legal career in handling these kinds of cases, these kinds of issues, as well as in church-state relations, discrimination, free speech, and similar matters. He is also, prior to the work with the ADL, he has served as Director of Special Projects for the Greater New York Conference on Soviet Jewry and has been a staff attorney for the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. He's a graduate of Yale University and Stanford Law School and comes to us to discuss this issue today. Please join me in welcoming Steve Freeman.
Thank you very much. Thank you, General Meese. Thank you to the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society for co-sponsoring this program. It's an honor for me to be here and to participate on behalf of the Anti-Defamation League. I'd like to start with a word about ADL. I imagine many of you are familiar with us, but ADL is an organization founded 95 years ago to stop the defamation of the Jewish people and to secure justice and fair treatment for all. Our mandate for almost a century has been to fight hate, and to fight bigotry, and to fight anti-Semitism. Having said that, we recognize, and I think this is a very important point to start with, that we can't outlaw hate. It's not so simple just to say, okay, hate, go away, and it disappears. We can't rule it out by law, and the process, really, the fight, the major battles are educational battles, are trying to, and the vast majority of our resources are devoted to programs where we try to teach children tolerance. We try to teach people how to confront anti-Semitism, how to confront bigotry, how to confront hate, how to look for solutions that are not resorting to courts and not resorting to legislation. And that's really where the main battle is. We recognize and we have a deep and abiding appreciation for the First Amendment, and we always have. Having said that, I want to add that we see hate crimes laws as a rather blunt instrument. Every time a hate crimes law is used, it means in some other way our society has failed. The crime has happened. The bigotry has been expressed. Somebody has been beaten up, assaulted, or an institution has been vandalized because of hate. And in some way, that education hasn't reached people it needed to reach. And it's an ongoing challenge, and I want to have everybody understand that that really is the priority. Of course, that doesn't mean that there aren't legal tools that can be used legitimately to respond to hate when there is underlying criminal conduct. And that's where hate crimes laws come in. I've been asked to talk about specifically about some of the First Amendment issues related to hate crimes laws, and I'm happy to do that. Let me start by posing a question. Who really has a problem with hate crimes laws from a First Amendment perspective? And I'm talking more broadly about hate crimes laws, not just about the federal legislation, which Mark addressed in very comprehensive detail in his 3 minutes. It's not the Supreme Court to start with. We're coming up on the 15th anniversary of the landmark decision in Wisconsin versus Mitchell, a 9-0 decision by the Supreme Court upholding a Wisconsin hate crimes law based on model legislation that ADL drafted almost 2 decades ago. In that decision, the court said that the statute punishes conduct. It's permissible for the state to consider motive. They made an analogy to anti-discrimination laws, and they said the statute has a legitimate legislative purpose to respond to conduct that inflicts harm on a broader society. In the actual words of Chief Justice Rehnquist, who wrote the decision, Mitchell argues that the Wisconsin penalty enhancement statute is invalid because it punishes the defendant's discriminatory motive or reason for acting. But motive plays the same role under the Wisconsin statute as it does under federal and state anti-discrimination laws, which we have previously upheld against constitutional challenge. The court doesn't have a problem, and that was obviously a court that had the, across the spectrum politically. Civil rights groups, traditional organizations that advocate on behalf of the First Amendment, like great claim to that, such as the ACLU, supported the statute in the Mitchell case. They didn't have a problem with the First Amendment, with a free speech issue there. One of the more remarkable amicus briefs filed in that case was filed on behalf of 49 attorneys general from all 49 other states in support of the Wisconsin statute. From a law enforcement perspective, it was clearly something seen as a useful tool. And these are not squishy-headed, bleeding-heart, touchy-feely types. Law enforcement sees it as an important tool. Mark mentioned earlier, bears worth repeating, that supporters of the federal legislation include a whole roster of the leading national law enforcement agencies who obviously understand the importance of this tool in their arsenal for combating hate and understand the impact that this hate can have on broader society. The International Association of Chiefs of Police, the National District Attorneys Association, the National Association of Attorneys General, National Sheriff's Association. I wouldn't take lightly the fact that all these organizations attach significant importance to this, and they understand the role of local law enforcement, and they understand that federal law enforcement can play an important role in backstopping local law enforcement, not in taking over for what local enforcement does, but in working together. One of the reasons they were able to succeed in the Jasper case in Texas, the Byrd case, was because federal resources, the FBI's forensic resources and expertise, were able to be brought to bear cooperatively with the state authorities to bring the case, to make the case. That would not have been possible without federal legislation providing for some jurisdiction. And there are limitations on the federal jurisdiction on when the federal authorities can come in. I think that it's important to add that in terms of intent, take an example of a driver driving down the street acting recklessly, negligently, hits somebody and kills the person. Now, suppose the same driver driving down the street is hitting somebody who is scheduled to testify as a witness against him in a case. The person would be equally dead in both cases. In each case, it's a homicide. But the penalty is substantially different under our law because we understand and our society has made a judgment that in one case it has a greater consequence for society and therefore it warrants tougher punishment. There are examples throughout the criminal code making such distinctions based on intent. And the key, and in this case I agree with Professor Harriet, the key is selection. The key is the intent. That's what makes the statute constitutional. That's what makes it survive that First Amendment scrutiny, because we're not looking into necessarily whether the person hates. We're looking into the impact it has on a broader society. And that crime, if somebody is targeted because of their status, has a significant impact on a much broader community. And we've learned our lessons from the Byrd case, from the Lemrick Nelson, Yonkel Rosenbaum killing in Crown Heights in Brooklyn, from the Rodney King case, from many other cases of the polarizing effect that such crimes can have on our broader society. And legislatures can make a legitimate judgment that this kind of conduct warrants tougher sentencing. I want to end with a note that we work, one of the things that's unusual about ADL is that we work both with the civil rights community and with law enforcement. We have one foot in each camp, as you will. We're part of and proud to be part of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, and we have a longstanding concern about civil rights issues and First Amendment issues and protecting individual rights. We also work very closely with law enforcement in fighting extremism and terrorism and working on training and working on programs that track activities of the extreme right and the extreme left, neo-Nazi skinheads and the Klan and Nation of Islam and other groups. And in each case, we understand and appreciate what the different needs are. One of the things that's particularly interesting about our work on behalf of hate crimes is that in both contexts, both on the side of the civil rights groups that we work with and the civil liberties groups that we work with and the law enforcement groups that we work with, there is a consensus that this is a useful, important, and constitutionally sound tool and an important one to have in our arsenal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Our final speaker is Professor John Baker. Professor Baker is the Dale Bennett Professor of Law at the Louisiana State University at their law center there. He has been active in a number of constitutional issues. He's worked with us here at with both the Federalist Society and Heritage on a number of issues and is working with us at the present time. He has taught with Justice Scalia in short courses. He is also has law enforcement experience. He's been a clerk, a law clerk for federal courts. He's been an assistant district attorney, as well as having written on a number of topics. He has been a member of the Justice Department as a consultant, as well as to the Senate Judiciary Committee, as well as the White House and the United States Information Agency. With that broad background and a particular expertise in issues such as this, it's a pleasure to present to you and help me welcome John Baker.
Thank you, General Meese. I've also written on the topic in the Boston University Law Review and had the pleasure for that to testify before the House Judiciary Committee some years ago and get beaten up by several members of the panel because of my position against hate crimes. In 2000, a French court convicted Brigitte Bardot of a hate crime. Her crime? Well, the former actress and aging sex symbol had turned animal rights activist, and she had criticized a Muslim festival for slaughtering sheep. The statute punished inciting, quote, discrimination, hatred, or racial violence. Now, fortunately for people like Lou Dobbs, who routinely rant against Islamofascist, that kind of conviction cannot happen in the United States due to the First Amendment. Here we have many more lawyers, however, and approaching the issue is much more subtle. And on the Hill, what they do is engage in very complicated statute drafting. And as a result, however, what we get is no less politicized. The beginning, Mark gave us supposedly a summary of the statute, the kind of summary you would expect from someone on the Hill. The problem is that it doesn't go to the guts of the statute. And Steve, when he got up, he talked about sentence enhancements. There are different issues that are being put together here that are not the same issue. A sentence enhancement issue is after the conviction for the crime. Sentence enhancements have their own problems under what's called the Apprendi Doctrine as to whether or not the jury actually found the particular element that is used to enhance the sentence. That is different from dealing with the issue of hate in the statute itself. And that distinction has not been made. To some extent, Gail got on this and talked about certain issues. But I want to take you from the point of view of a prosecutor, which is what I used to be, and a defense attorney, which I am now, and to look at what the elements of the statute really are. And I want to take a particular one so that you can actually see it. And if I wanted to prosecute, and speaking of Lou Dobbs, let's take an immigration issue. Here's what I would have to prosecute, all I would have to prove. Whoever willfully causes bodily injury to a person because of perceived national origin, okay, under certain circumstances. What are those circumstances? During the course of traveling of the victim across a national border. Okay, police in Arizona grab somebody who's come across the border in the process of arresting him, they inflict injury, and it's perceived they did it because he was crossing a national border and his national origin was that he was from south of the border. Bingo! We heard about jurisdiction and wonderful limitations on jurisdiction. Didn't hear the last one. The last one was about, is there a federal interest that the state is not enforcing? Well, guess what? Under immigration, there is no state interest. It's exclusively a federal interest. This statute, as Gail pointed out, was deliberately drafted this way. This is no accident. This is no accident. Here's what the issues are. Federalism, yes, but different. Hate crimes shouldn't be a crime at the state or federal level insofar as you are talking about the act and the intent. Why? We are politicizing crime. That is fundamentally violative of the rule of law and all notions of the rule of law. Under this, if you are a member of the listed groups, any violence against you is a federal crime. Simple. That is it. Jurisdictional issues, all of them are subject to caveats. The fundamental guts of this statute is, if you are a member of this group, any violence against you is a federal crime, but if you are not a member of this group, you're not protected by the same federal legislation. It's that simple. You can put all of the wrapping you want around it, but you can't get around the fact that this is class-based legislation. Simple as it is. It is clearly unconstitutional if we stick to Morrison. Remember Morrison? After Lopez? It was the Violence Against Women Act. And it was struck down and not justified under either the Commerce Clause or the 14th Amendment, even though, quote, it was tied to motivation by gender. It was a hate crime. We didn't use the term. Court struck it down. This is an example of feel-good legislation. We get it not only at the federal level, we get it at the state level, all kinds of feel-good levels. And we get class and economic legislation. In our state, you may know we have alligators. So theft of an alligator is, you know, that's really a serious crime. The problem was that then the shrimp farmers and the crawfish farmers and the dog owners and everybody else wanted their special legislation. It's completely worthless. Every DA knows it. They'll stand up and say, yes, of course I support the dog lovers of the United States. I support the alligator owners. I support all of these people. Look at what they prosecute. Do they ever prosecute these things? No. Why? Because they're irrelevant. They're unneeded. Well, why can't we just have more irrelevant laws at the federal level? What's the problem? It's fundamentally different. There is fundamentally no political accountability for federal prosecutors the way there is for state prosecutors. I'm not saying state prosecutors are all great, but they've got to stand for election. There is so much federal crime that there is no way for the federal prosecutors to prosecute it all. It is highly, highly, highly selective. How are we going to select then? In the area of hate crime, it is going to be media reaction. It was mentioned about church fires. I was on the State Civil Rights Commission in Louisiana under the U.S. Civil Rights Commission when we were looking at the issue of church fires and all of this. And there was this great uproar. And afterwards, we did the statistics, and it turned out that during the period that we were looking at it so concerned about, there were no more church fires during that period than there had been before. It was the shark attack effect. When the media reports shark attacks, people are afraid of sharks. But when you go back and you run the numbers, you find out that shark attacks are the same as they've always been. We are going to get prosecution by media, and that's what it's all about. Fundamental crime is, traditionally, deals with a prohibited act and a mens rea and a consequence that follows from that. Much of the problem here is really due not just to liberals who want to do hate crimes, but it's due to Republicans and conservatives who want to criminalize everything. Indeed, at the federal level, we've lost the notion of what a crime is. Why? Because it's very difficult to have a real federal crime. It's all based on regulation. We have shifted from the fundamental notion of prohibited act and a mens rea to regulatory matters that therefore become complicated and politicized. And what's especially bad about hate crimes is that we are going beyond the mental element and the act, and we are going into motive. To go into motive is to go into conscience. It may be wrong to be a bigot, but it is not criminal to be a bigot. We change bigotry through education, through churches, through family, etc. The state has no business probing into conscience, but only prohibiting certain acts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Baker. We have a few moments in which any members of the panel who would like to respond have that opportunity. Who would like to take 1 or 2 minutes to respond? Mark?
Sure, I'd be happy to. There's a lot on the table, so let me just touch a couple of the major points that were made by, I think, both professors. First, we've heard a parade of horribles about this legislation. We've heard that this will create an end run around state criminal laws, and particularly due process protections. I think this belies the now lengthy experience that we've had with state statutes that deal with hate crimes in much the same way as the proposed federal legislation. And there's simply no evidence that this terrible consequence is taking place. Similarly, there's no evidence that we are that juries are looking at these cases and convicting people of hate crimes for any violence against a member of a listed group. The onus is on the government to prove its case, as always, and the onus is on a demonstration that has to be made that the identity of the victim as a member of one of these groups is in fact the reason for the crime, not simply an incidental feature of the crime. And that is a question of evidence. And I think the jury system has always been capable of sorting out these kinds of questions. I think it's really a red herring to say that anybody who's a member of any group who is in any way damaged or harmed, whether by law enforcement at the border or anywhere else, is thereby a victim of a hate crime. That's not the intent, and that's not what it says. Finally, this statute that's being proposed, like the state statutes on which it has been modeled, does not criminalize bigotry. I think we all agree that in this country we don't do that sort of thing. We may dislike views, we may dislike hate speech. The Supreme Court has spoken quite clearly on the distinction between hate speech statutes and hate crimes statutes that involve bodily injury, acts of violence. That's what we're talking about here, and I think it's a great distraction to suggest that this is about letting people express their views or not express their views. But that is not what's at issue here.
Professor Harriet, do you have?
Just to respond on this. Got 3 points to make. The notion that the state hate crime laws have not been a problem. Well, first of all, certainly it wouldn't be a problem on the double jeopardy issue because that issue simply doesn't arise. It's not possible for the state to give rise to two prosecutions. So that issue is completely separate. Second, the language of the state statutes is often very different and often really does require some level of proof of not necessarily hatred, but at least prejudice. It's worth pointing out that the bill that is before Congress now has embedded in it the very feud that I was referring to. The part of the statute that deals with allowing the federal government to assist state governments defines the offense where it will help very differently. The crime must be motivated by prejudice. Motivated by prejudice based on race, color, gender, blah, 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 blah. But when you get over to the part about the federal crime, all that's required is that it occur because of the race, color, religion, national origin of some person. It doesn't even have to be the victim. So it's quite clear that in the drafting of this bill, very consciously, it is decided to define what gets called a hate crime very, very broadly. And again, the Department of Justice refused to say that they did not believe that all rapes will be covered by this. You know, they clearly do believe that all rapes will be covered by this statute, and they clearly relish the discretion to determine which one of those rapes they're going to prosecute as a federal crime and which one they are not going to prosecute as a federal crime. Third, just to adopt John's point here, another difference between state and federal level crimes here is simply that state's attorneys are elected and U.S. attorneys are not. And that's going to make a difference in the accountability of those prosecutors to the people.
Mr. Friedman.
Thank you. A couple of quick points. First, I want to point out, a lot's been said already, and not just here, about the notion that this legislation applies to members of specific groups. But the way the legislation is written, it talks about because of or by reason of race, national origin, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, and so forth. Well, everyone has a race. Everyone has a nationality. Everyone has an ethnic origin. The Wisconsin case I mentioned, the landmark Supreme Court case, it happened that the victim was white and the perpetrators were African-American. The statute as it is written reflects a legislative judgment that hate crimes can be polarizing regardless of whether the victim is a member of a minority or a majority. It's the nature of living in a diverse society where there is often racial and ethnic tension, particularly in our urban areas. And the conflicts can go and do go both directions, and the statute is not written only to apply to members of minority groups, and that's also a deliberate decision on the part of those who drafted it. The other point I would make is that we heard terms like this is, you know, fielded legislation, this is politicizing crime. We hear lots of complaints from time to time about courts legislating. This is an example of a legislature legislating, and an example of a legislature legislating based on a determination, investigating, get facts, and hearing what's going on in the communities about what's perceived as a danger to society. And my understanding is exactly what a legislature is supposed to do is investigate and respond to those kinds of questions and those kinds of concerns when they're satisfied that they're real and they have a broader impact on a community. They can have a polarizing effect, they can cause people to feel vulnerable, they can cause people to feel as if they're not supported by the law. So exactly what the legislature here, in my perspective, from ADL's perspective, is doing exactly what it should be doing, looking at what's going on out there, looking at the nature of the danger posed, and responding to it.
Professor Baker.
I was on the U.S. Civil
Into the mic.
I was on the U.S. Civil Rights Commission for Louisiana. Gail's been on the National Civil Rights Commission. The reality is that when different administrations come in and appoint different people to these committees, there is a clash of what people think is really civil rights. And so when I went on the Reagan administration, the traditional civil rights groups were represented there, and when issues like religion and other categories that are mentioned here were suggested as topics of investigation, this was treated as if this was totally irrelevant. The reality is that every administration has its own political constituencies. But to use the criminal law to enforce the preferences of political constituencies politicizes the criminal law. And that is a serious danger in this country.
We're going to turn it over to the audience for your questions and comments. Hopefully, your questions should be related to the discussion that we've had with the speakers here. Before we do, though, I'd like to ask one question of the panel. And it seems to me that in view of the title of the subject here, is the federal government, should the federal government be involved, is there a federal role in hate crimes legislation? The framers of the Constitution said that there was one specific responsibility that would be left to the states and to local government, and that was the administration of civil and criminal justice. And so over the history of the United States, for most of its history, we have had normal criminal activity enforced and prosecuted at the state and local level. In recent years, there has been an unfortunate tendency, as indicated by the Federalization of Crime Task Force of the ABA that Mr. Agrest mentioned earlier, of the federal government getting involved in a duplicate set of criminal laws which were never contemplated by the founders, which led to the issue that Professor Harriet brought up, and that is double prosecution. The reason why the separate jurisdictions were permitted in the Constitution was the fact that it was not contemplated the federal government would get into ordinary criminal prosecutions. Why is there a need? Why is there a federal role? What would cause us to say that the police power should be extended to the federal government in a non-traditional fashion, such as this legislation? Who would like to talk about that? Mr. Agrest?
Sure. I think that is the question that's at the crux here. The role of the federal government in this area is a limited one. And I think the authors of this bill recognize that, as does the Justice Department. This is a situation in which there is a gap in the ability of state, local, and tribal governments to focus on these problems and to devote the kinds of resources to them, often extraordinary resources, that they require. And what the bill does, it doesn't encourage duplicative prosecutions. Quite the contrary, it encourages cooperation between federal and state governments. It basically says to the states, we're here if you want us, if you want technical support, if you want forensic science to be brought to bear, if you want the resources that are available at the federal level to play some role in enhancing your capacity. That's what needs to happen. And the states, first of all, need to invite the federal government in under this statute unless one of the other circumstances obtains. The statute is very clear. It says one of four things has to happen. The state either lacks jurisdiction or does not intend to exercise jurisdiction. That's clearly not a case where there is any risk of unfair duplication. The state has requested that the federal government assume jurisdiction. Here again, there's no conflict between the state and the federal government. That's why so many local law enforcement officials and attorneys general are in favor of this bill. They're not worried that the federal government is going to come in and trump them. They want the ability to call upon the resources of the federal government when needed. Third, the state does not object to the federal government's assuming jurisdiction. Here again, where's the complaint? Where's the risk that this is going to become a double prosecution or a federal trump card over the states which rightly have primary jurisdiction here? The only other circumstance that the bill contemplates in which the federal government may step in is when the state fails to vindicate the federal interest in prosecuting hate crimes. If you don't believe there's such a federal interest, then there's probably nothing much to talk about. But I think the theory here, and I think it's the right one, is that there is a profound national interest in making sure that this kind of crime is treated with all the seriousness that it deserves, that it's not simply treated as routine, but that it is elevated, it is looked at a national level as a matter of national importance, and that it is nipped in the bud before it can spread.
Professor Baker.
Well, Mark has just admitted what I was talking about, that last provision about the federal interest. Okay, I'm a state prosecutor, and I say I see a crime, and I know it's motivated by hate. But for one thing, as a practical matter, to prove motive is much more difficult than to prove simply intent. So I decide that I'm going to prosecute and make sure I get a conviction because I don't want to give the jury and the defense another reason to try to defeat this conviction. And I simply convict on straight murder. And the federal authorities say, but you didn't prosecute for hate murder. Well, first of all, my response is that malice, because we've lost the understanding of it, malice means hate. But people don't know that. Any crime with malice is a hate crime. We just don't call it that. The word hate crime is redundant. Any true crime involves hate. But put that to one side. And the feds say, no, you didn't vindicate our interest in stamping out hate. My position is, I believe in the rule of law. I think, both as a practical matter and as a matter of the rule of law, I simply convict murderers, period.
Mr. Freeman. Just want to add one postscript to what Mark Agrath said, which is, in the last 10 years, the FBI has gotten approximately 7,000 or 8,000 reports of incidents, hate crimes incidents, every year. And in that same time frame, there have been, I think, 43 prosecutions under the federal hate crime statute, or an average of about 4 a year out of 7,000 to 8,000 incidents reported. So just based on experience, the notion that crimes are suddenly going to be federalized, everybody's going to be prosecuted in federally, it doesn't bear that out, and I don't really think that's likely to change under the new law. I think the main purpose of the law is a backstop to help in those circumstances, and it's a limited number of circumstances where, for one of the reasons enunciated already, the state authorities are either unwilling or unable to prosecute or don't have the resources they need to prosecute effectively, and therefore this offers another tool and puts another tool at their disposal.
Professor Harriet.
I just wanted to point out the reason there have not been a lot of federal prosecutions is that this bill hasn't passed yet. Duh. The statute that's in effect right now covers only a very limited number of things.
Professor Baker.
In my article, I did an analysis of the so-called explosion of hate crimes, and I did charts and all of this, something I don't enjoy doing, but it basically demonstrated that the numbers through 1998 were bogus. Okay, since then, there's been a lot of publicity. If you publicize enough, people are going to report, and they are going to come up with things that they're going to label as hate crimes. I pointed out the Morrison case. It wasn't labeled a hate crime. I can label it a hate crime and put it in. It's a numbers game. The fact that people are reporting or not reporting has nothing to do with the reality of what's happening.
At this point, let's turn to the audience, and we'll take your questions. Question in the front row here. Let's wait for the microphone, if you will. Go ahead.
George Liebman of the Calvert Institute in Baltimore. Let me address this question particularly to Mr. Freeman and Mr. Agrast. There's been very little said here about the historical origins of the present restriction on hate crimes. The present restrictions on the federal criminal civil rights statute were those defined in the Screws case in 1946. The author of the principal opinion in Screws was Justice Douglas, who was certainly an advocate of civil rights, and who declared that the civil rights law, if not given the restrictive construction which it now has, would lack the basic specificity necessary for criminal statutes under our system of government. There was a concurring opinion by three very notable justices, Justice Jackson, who had just returned from the Nuremberg trials and had no particular illusions about the benevolence of national governments, Justice Roberts, who had been the federal prosecutor of the Teapot Dome affair and who also had no such illusions, and Justice Frankfurter, who had a similar attitude. And they made the point, a policy of strict self-limitation is not accompanied by assurance of permanent tenure and immortality of those who make it the policy. Evil men are rarely given power. They take it over from better men to whom it had been entrusted. There can be no doubt that this shapeless and all-encompassing statute can be an all-embracing statute can serve as a dangerous instrument of political intimidation and coercion in the hands of those so inclined. And their fear was, and is especially dramatic in view of the facts of the Screws case, which were horrible facts involving a beating by a Southern sheriff, their fear was that if you allowed the federal government to dispense with the requirement of a specific purpose to deprive someone of a constitutional right, you would put the federal government in a position where it could govern state and local law enforcement by simply threatening prosecutions of state officers for every questioned arrest. And why is that not a legitimate concern? What has happened in the last 60 years to give us greater confidence in the inevitable benevolence of national governments?
Okay. Who wants to take that, Mr. Agress or Mr. Freeman?
I'll take it first. And I think in terms of the analysis of the Screws case and the constitutionality under federal law of the statute, it's a question of interpretation of the 13th Amendment and the badges and incidents language and whether or not that's sufficient to provide jurisdiction. I suspect that ultimately will be decided by the courts. The position that we take and the position that proponents of the legislation take is that that does now provide a sufficient jurisdictional basis for this statute. And I think in terms of the rest of your question, I've already talked about why it's important and what the experience has taught us. We may end up agreeing to disagree. I don't think I'm going to change your mind. Our experience has been, and we deal with this on a daily basis through offices around the country, they're actually dealing with bias-motivated crimes and incidents and so forth, that most of the time, many occasions, state jurisdiction is sufficient and appropriate, but there have been times when it isn't, and there is a judgment has been made that we need the federal legislation to fill in those gaps and to provide that backstop, and that we think it can be done in a constitutionally sound way. I recognize, based on where you're coming from, that you're probably not going to agree with that, but that's the position we take, and ultimately I suspect a court will resolve it.
Mr. Agress.
Just to add to that, I believe the question also addressed the origin of the current restrictions in the application of the 1968 hate crimes law, which is still on the books. The inadequacy of that regime, the reason it has to be addressed, actually goes to something one of the other speakers harped on, the use of the because language. The because language, because of racial animus, may be a feature of the proposed statute, but in fact there is because language that has impeded proper prosecutions all along in the existing statute, and that is that the statute requires proof that the victims were attacked because they were engaged in one of six enumerated federally protected activities, such as voting. It doesn't say that they were engaged and therefore in the course of engaging in voting activities, they were attacked. In fact, many prosecutions have failed or not been brought because they couldn't meet the requirement that the reason was that they were engaged in voting. It's an extremely hard threshold to meet. It's really an impractical way to draft a statute. And so it's really been something of a dead letter for most purposes ever since. That's why this new statute is proposed. Why I think it will be much more efficacious. I wonder if I could also just respond to one other point.
Well, let's take Professor Baker's response, and then we'll give you a chance.
Sure.
Go ahead.
You make my point, the difficulty of the because of language. But when federal power comes in, you can't afford to defend a federal prosecution unless you've got a couple hundred thousand at a minimum. And so what the statute does is to add the word after because of the actual or perceived racial. Now, the whole idea that it is actually focusing on the motivation of the defendant is out the window. It's because of the perceptions of other people. Now, in order to make the proof easier, which is what he's admitted,
you've now taken it totally away from the original rationale, and you've objectified it so that it will be perceptions created by the media. That's what this is.
Well, I completely disagree with that, obviously.
Well, look at the language and tell me where in the language.
You didn't discuss
the language when you actually discussed the bill. Read the language.
The language, when it says perceived, let's say perceived sexual orientation, that is the perception of the defendant.
It doesn't say that.
That's the only reasonable reading of that language.
Would you agree to put that language in?
Well, I'm not in control of the bill. I didn't draft it. I certainly think that you ought to raise that with the people who drafted it, but I think it's quite clear from the context that when we say that the animus that is directed at an individual is because of the person's actual...
The word animus doesn't appear here.
Well, could I just make my point and then you can make yours? The comment that Professor Baker made earlier was, and I believe I have this accurately, all malice is hate. Mm-hmm. All malice is hate. I think that is a real misunderstanding of the criminal justice system to say that every act of malice, and if you are, I mean, you hate in a sort of generic sense, perhaps, when you say, I dislike this person as an individual, I feel malice toward him or her, that is a very different thing than saying that you bear an animus against an entire community, and the person you are attacking for that reason, not because this is a person you dislike personally. You don't even know this person. What you know, and all you know, is that this is a person who is a member of a group you dislike intensely, or is a member, or you perceive this person to be a member of that group. That may, in fact, not be the case. You might think, as in some hate crimes cases, that the person you're attacking is gay or is a transgender individual, and that may in fact be untrue. But nevertheless, you have committed a hate crime against that person on the basis that you thought that was in fact the case.
Professor Harriet.
I just want to clarify something here. As I said earlier, there's nothing that requires hatred. There's nothing that requires animus here. That word does not appear in the part of the statute that deals with defining the crime. It simply says that, whoever willfully causes bodily injury to any person, blah, 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 because of the actual or perceived race, color, religion, or national origin of any person. Because of, I stole the purse of the lady in the wheelchair because I figured she couldn't get me. Whereas the person who was walking could probably run after me, get the purse back, and whack me over the head. I picked that victim because of her disability.
Okay, let's turn to the next question, right up here.
Maybe getting to the crux of it, with a little bit of a long question here, is what is hate? Billy Jack Gaither, a homosexual man, was robbed and murdered at Peckerwood Creek in Alabama. 2 years later, at the Pelham exit on I-65, one lady shot another competitive driver during rush hour and was convicted of murder. Soon thereafter, a brat of two people that I grew up with burned down a half a dozen churches, black and white alike, out in rural areas. Would some of those be double hate crimes because of the race of the people who attended those churches? While a number of years earlier, a child named Jess Dirkhising was bound, gagged, and buggered to death by his next-door neighbor and his lover. In only the third and the last instance was the victim known to the perpetrator. So which of these was hate? And would you dare label any of these criminals as being evil?
Okay, who would like to answer that? Professor Baker?
In law school criminal classes, they've completely lost the understanding of malice. But if you track it back, it goes to the distinction between a hateful heart and a person who has committed a wrong. And we used to make the distinction between a misdemeanor and a felony, and a felony had to have malice. It had to be driven by hate. The problem is we've criminalized so many things, and we've moved misdemeanors to felonies, that we've completely obliterated this context. So when what you're doing is public, especially at the federal level, when you're punishing as crimes things that aren't really crimes, people begin to think, well, crime isn't as bad as it used to be. I mean, we know, and I won't name some of them, some well-known people who, after having served federal time, have gone on to illustrious careers or resumed their illustrious careers. So it's not the infamy that it used to be. And when you create many more crimes, that's what happens. You dilute it. And so if people feel that they don't want to just be subject to an ordinary crime which doesn't really require a mens rea, I can understand that they want to get the sense of hate back. Well, let's return to the basic understanding of what a crime is, a felony, that involves malice. And that is all about hate.
Okay. Who else? Anybody else want to comment on the question?
Sure. I want to start by, obviously, wouldn't minimize the pain in any of these cases of the victims or their families or their friends or the community. Sometimes we lose sight of the fact that in every crime, there is a victim, and the victim deserves our sympathy and our concern. The context in which we look at these crimes, these hate crimes or bias-motivated crimes, is broader because of the greater societal impact they have on communities, on cities, on neighborhoods. And sometimes also we lose sight of that when we're talking about the intent. The reason that legislatures have made a decision that bias crimes warrant tougher sentences is because the pain and the victimization transcends the individual affected by it and transcends that person's family, and it has a much broader ripple effect on entire communities and entire societies. And the Crown Heights situation that I lived through in New York is a classic example of, you know, causing a riot or near riot situation. That's really, I think, the prism through which I look at that. And I don't say any of them don't manifest some form of hate. I'm not enamored of the word hate to use these statutes. I think it's much more talking about the bias and so forth on the broader impact on the community. I just wanted to just, while I have the mic, say one thing about what Professor Harriet said, too. We have a very sophisticated body of anti-discrimination laws in this country, and those laws typically don't refer to animus at all. But they do punish people, they do provide for sanctions if you refuse to hire somebody, if you refuse to continue to employ somebody, if you refuse to give somebody food in a public accommodation because of that person's status. It doesn't have to show animus for the person to be accused of and found guilty of discrimination. And I think there is an analogy here between the body of anti-discrimination laws that exists and these hate crimes laws. The Supreme Court, in fact, in the Mitchell case that I quoted earlier, made that comparison. So just saying that there is not animus in the law is kind of missing an important point.
I think it is true, though, Mr. Freeman, that in the cases you cited about failure to provide food and that sort of thing, those are civil laws, not criminal laws.
Except for when they rise in the context of 18 to 42.
Professor Harriet?
Let me just say that makes this a political fraud, because the American people are being told that this is a bill about hate crimes, and it's not. It's a bill about crimes that are committed because of the race, gender, sexual orientation, disability, religion, etc., of some person. It doesn't even have to be the victim. The examples that you gave, you can pretty much make any crime, particularly with the disability aspect of this. And if you work hard enough and you ask that person who committed the crime, why did you do this? Why did you pick out this victim? There are going to be huge, huge numbers of crimes that are going to fit under this. And crimes that, nobody would dream of thinking of as a hate crime. I gave the example a few minutes ago. If I'm upset with my assistant because she's not typing fast enough, and I whack her, and lo and behold, it turns out that the reason that she can't type very fast is because she's got carpal tunnel syndrome. That fits the definition of what we're told is a hate crime. Except it's not a hate crime. It's just, a bratty law professor who's whacking somebody she shouldn't be whacked. A fairly minor thing in the grand scheme of things. Should I be punished? Yes. Is she justified in suing me? Yes. Should I be fired? Yes. Should the state's attorney charge me with misdemeanor for whacking her? But, should it be a federal hate crime? Come on. Yeah, this is the way it's being sold, and that's a fraudulent way to sell this bill.
I think the actual situation that we're talking about has something more to do with lynchings than it has to do with rapping someone on the knuckles for mistyping a document.
Then draft a statute that says that.
Okay, let's move along to the next question here so we don't spend all of our time on the colloquy between the panelists. Over here.
For John, do you really mean to say that all animus or bad intentions or malice, I think is the word you use, is hate?
No, I didn't say all bad intentions. This goes back to the origin of the term malice in connection with crime goes back to Aristotle's Ethics. It was picked up in the Middle Ages when crime was developed. It's the basis of the common law of crime. There were very few felonies. There was a marked distinction between a felony and a misdemeanor. Today, we've lost that sense largely because law professors couldn't figure out what malice meant. They didn't know anything about philosophy. We've taken the notion that anything you want to prohibit, that it's totally a matter of simply deciding what the penalty is, and that would be the distinction between misdemeanor and felony. And we've lost the whole concept of mens rea. We've diluted it, and that's what's the problem, by and large, in federal laws.
Question over here.
When I listen to this, I feel like there's sort of a clash of worldviews here, that you guys are talking about lynchings and people being dragged behind trucks and stuff like this. And I think many of the people here, and I want you to speak to this, is that at the university campuses, their hate speech codes are basically viewed as if somebody says anything that offends them. So if they say, I believe marriage is one man and one woman, and that's perceived to be hate, then it's some administrative proceeding. They don't go to jail for that. But that, you know, hate speech, hate crimes, it's all kind of a continuum. You know, if you say Jesus Christ is the only way of salvation, that's a hate crime to somebody who doesn't believe that and perceives it that way. And so the perception, when you're talking about hate crimes, is more that it's used as a weapon to demonize people on one side of a discussion and then to accuse them of bigotry, of some sort of offense. It may not be a criminal offense. And that, so for example, I have a case that I'm defending right now before the New Mexico Human Rights Commission where a photographer declined to take photos of a same-sex ceremony, and she's being prosecuted now for an act of sexual oriented discrimination by public accommodation. I realize that's different legislation, but it's basically you can't have a discussion or a disagreement without it being hate if you disagree with the kind of the politically correct side. So I think that that's, and I realize that this legislation doesn't go to it, but I think that that's sort of the ethos that you're speaking into and the great concern that this is just going to metastasize into some big law, maybe 10 years, you know, if Barack Obama and a heavily Democratic Congress elects this, then we're going to see all the photographers and caterers who don't want to do same-sex marriages lined up, you know, and attack, because we got to get bigotry at its root. If we don't get it there, it's going to end up with these hate crimes. You know, that's the kind of logic that's going to go.
Okay, Mr. Freeman.
Let me start by saying, let me start where I started my talk an hour and a half ago. Hate speech is protected, constitutionally protected by the First Amendment. You can't send somebody to jail for saying bigoted things, whether it's on campus or anywhere else, and ADL would oppose that. If we oppose campus codes, we don't think that they're consistent with the First Amendment. People may be surprised to hear that that's our position, but it is. I think there is a very clear, straight, bright line kind of distinction between speech and criminal conduct, and what the statutes that we support do is talk about enhancing the penalty when there is criminal conduct and the victim is targeted, the perpetrator targets the victim because of that victim's status. If it's an offensive speech, the answer is education. The answer is teaching tolerance and encouraging people to understand why it's bad and why they shouldn't do it, and hopefully they will understand, putting people in a room together, trying to explain the damage that causes to our society. The answer to that is not the criminal justice system, and we would speak out against somebody who tried to do that. So to the extent that there is a, you're talking about a spectrum there, I think there is a very clear distinction there.
Okay, we'll give each of our participants 1 minute to respond. Mr. Agras will come right down the line.
Great. I don't need a full minute. I think the point is very well taken, and I agree with Mr. Freeman that this is a very different kettle of fish. We also do not support campus speech codes that purport to restrict expression, particularly in a university environment that is supposedly dedicated to the values of dialogue and free expression. By the same token, I think it has to be admitted that there is something of a continuum, at least as the courts have looked at the First Amendment. Obviously, there are forms of speech that constitute incitement that have been sanctioned. And I wouldn't want to suggest that you can say anything to anyone if the courts have already made it clear that there are some limits even on the sacred right to express yourself. And I think that the distinction in the hate crimes context comes down to whether you are legitimately putting people in fear of their lives or of grievous bodily harm by your actions, by your physical conduct, or potentially even by your speech acts, as the courts have termed them. I think those are very different things from expressing your opposition to a particular norm or to a particular form of conduct, or expressing your political or religious views, which you should be fully insulated when you do.
Professor Harriet, 1 minute.
Just in response to that question?
In response to that question, yes.
Then I'll pass.
All right. Professor Baker.
I'm somewhat puzzled by what Steve Freeman said, because he keeps repeating enhanced penalty. Enhanced penalty is a very different issue from the guts of the criminal statute. And some of the examples that Gail's been giving, you may think are strange, they're not going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. I actually tracked the history of federal criminal law for almost 100 years on the number of occasions that Congress passed something and they said, this is what we intended to do. And then even some congressmen objected to the way it was enforced. And my response is, well, you idiot, you didn't read the language. And that is the problem. I worked in the Senate, and I don't know of very many senators who ever read the criminal bills, much less other bills. In fact, I testified on the federal criminal code, and the staff hadn't read much of the criminal code. But when it gets down to prosecuting cases, that's what it's all about. So, Steve, when you talk about the enhancement penalty, that has nothing to do with what we're talking about.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the end of a little over an hour and a half. Please join me in thanking our panel for a very spirited discussion. Thank you all for being with us.